chapter 7. And this contains a well-known verse that actually has created a bit of an uproar in the middle of the 20th century, Isaiah chapter 7. Now, we have jumped ahead a number of years as far as the setting is concerned. We are, the year is 734 BC. This is the reign of King Ahaz. And there is an alliance to the north. In your King James Version, it'll say Syria. That's what the country is called today. It was the kingdom of Aram, A-R-A-M is what it is in Hebrew. But the capital was Damascus. Damascus and Jericho are the two oldest continuously inhabited places on earth today. Both of them have been of course we know biblically there was a brief respite for Jericho after the destruction after coming in. But generally speaking, both those places have been inhabited for at least 4,000 years. So oldest cities in the world. And you had the Arameans with their headquarters in Damascus, the capital in Damascus, and Pekah, who is king of the northern kingdom of Israel with its capital at Samaria. And Aram and Israel had gotten together, had formed an alliance for a twofold purpose. One primary purpose, the next one was secondary. In Mideast politics over the centuries, you had, for the most part, until you get right toward the end with the destruction of Jerusalem and so forth, prior to that time, you had two main powers that went back and forth as far as who was the most powerful. Earlier on, it was Egypt. And Egypt occasionally would form an empire, would spill out of Egypt, and they would go up the coast and take as far north as Syria and maybe even the southern coast of what is now Turkey. They would take all of Palestine and go west as well and take Cyrene, which is part of modern Libya. They would take some of the islands in the Mediterranean. They would have an empire, and they would bulge out once in a while, and then that pharaoh would die, and then his successor wouldn't have as much ambition, so the thing would come back down to Egypt. It would pulse like this. The other one was the Assyrians, and their capital was at Nineveh, which is in the northern part of modern Iraq. That would be the Kurdish area of northern Iraq today. And the capital there, Nineveh, was a very, very ancient city. It was founded by Nimrod, who is there in Genesis, talked about before the Tower of Babel incident. And so you had, no, is he? Yes, prior to the Tower of Babel. And so a very ancient city. Now, the Assyrians would also pulse. Sometimes they would just control what is northern Iraq, and there's other times that they pulsed out and they would take the whole eastern half of Turkey. They would take all of what is now Iraq. They would also take Syria. They would take what is now Israel and Jordan and Syria and Lebanon, and even on at least one or two occasions go down and they took Egypt as well. And so they went through these stages of pulses, and then you'd have a weaker king or a guy who just didn't have the ambition, and it would come back in and be much smaller. And at this point in time, with Ahaz's reign, Assyria is on the rise, and they are moving to the southwest, and they have now taken what is now all of Iraq, and they are moving over toward the Mediterranean. They have taken what is northern Syria today, over toward the Mediterranean, where it borders Turkey. They moved into eastern Turkey as well, and now they're beginning to head southwest toward Egypt. And you had these small kingdoms. You had, of course, Edom and Ammon and Moab. But these are little tiny kingdoms. These are not much more than city-states as far as their power and stuff is concerned. The power brokers in that, and the Philistines are still in existence, but they, again, a little city-state thing. They're nothing to be of consequence. The main players in that part of the world are the Syrians out of Damascus, Israel, the northern kingdom, with their headquarters, with their capital in Samaria, and the southern kingdom of Judah, with their capital at Jerusalem. Those were the buffer states that were between the Assyrians in the north and the Egyptians in the south. And the Syrians and the Israelites had gotten together, formed an alliance to try to stop the Assyrians from coming in. And they are going to Jerusalem, and they had tried earlier on to get Ahaz to become party number three of their alliance. And Ahaz says, no way. No way. Because the Assyrians are going to win. They are going to stomp you guys. They are going to wipe the floor with you. And we want to be able to survive. We want to make sure we're on the right side of this. And so they would not side with the Syrians and the Israelites. And so what you've got here is Syria and Israel are coming in to force Judah to become part of their alliance. And so it came to pass in the days of Ahaz, the son of Jotham, the son of Uzziah, king of Judah, that Rezin, the son of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, king of Israel, went up toward Jerusalem to war against it, but they could not prevail against it. That was the final outcome. So he's giving you a window of what will happen after chapter 7 takes place. And it was told the house of David, so the king was told this, saying Syria is confederate with Ephraim. Ephraim is a synonym for the northern kingdom. Ephraim would be the main tribe in the northern kingdom. Syria is confederate with Ephraim, and his heart was moved. The idea of moved doesn't mean, oh my, this is such a warm... No, that isn't the idea. It means it was shaken. He is scared. He is rattled by what he has heard, because he knows the Syrians have come down with troops, and they are camping in the northern kingdom of Israel, which means only that Israel has allowed them to come in, and if that's the case, they're heading south, and Jerusalem is the target. So Ahaz is really shaken. And granted, Jerusalem is a very defensible place, but how long a siege can they hold out and so forth? And it says, the heart of his people, as the trees of the wood, were moved with the wind. They are really scared to death. They're shaking. And so this is what they're anticipating. Then said the Lord unto Isaiah, go forth now to meet Ahaz, thou and thy, and Shear Jashub, thy son. Now, it's interesting, Isaiah has several children with names of significance. And by the way, there's a few names of particular significance in the Old Testament especially. For example, Abraham and Abram are significant. What does Isaac mean? Laughter. Because they laugh, saying, am I going to be able to have a child when I'm this old? And so when he actually did come around, they named him Laughter. And Isaiah's children have specific names as well. And this one, his name means literally a remnant shall return. In Hebrew, that's what his name means. And so Isaiah and his son go to meet the king at the end of the conduit of the upper pool in the highway of the Fuller's Field. Now, one of the things that we struggle with, I use we loosely, is what did Jerusalem look like in the kingdom era? And the problem is Jerusalem has been destroyed and rebuilt so many times that, and there are so many layers, and the fact that there's still a city there makes it difficult to do a lot of excavating. And so we're not exactly sure where this is. But we do know he went to check out the water supply, is what this amounts to, in case there is a siege. He's checking out the water supply. And it mentions the Fuller's Field. Now, we're familiar with Fuller is a last name. There's a lot of last names that are tied to various old-time occupations. You have Smith, Mason, Tanner, Skinner, Washer, Weaver, Taylor, Butcher, Cooper. Cooper, somebody that makes barrels. Carpenter, Sawyer, somebody who saws. All right. You have all these different names. What in the world's a fuller? It is an occupation name. Okay. Let's back up a little. This is going to be a long discussion for a short thing here, but I want to do it. What was in the 19th century? You had in the beginning of the 19th century, you had something called the Industrial Revolution, and it branched out and attacked and was involved in basically all fields of production. But what was the first one? What was the major thing that started the Industrial Revolution? What was the first field of production that was affected by that? Anybody know? David, do you know? I'll give you a hint. It wasn't cars. Nope. No, this is before even those. Once you got steam power, they started doing some things, and it was weaving and cloth production. Understand, in the old days, you had what was called homespun, and you had ladies sitting there with a spinning wheel producing all the thread that was used in all the cloth in all the world. It was done on these things that you pump, and you've seen them with the big wheel here, and that's how it was done. You had a few people that had the drop spindles. But that's how cloth was made. They would weave it out of the various fibers. And then you'd have these ladies who had these big looms, and they'd weave this thread back and forth by hand. and then they'd step on a pedal and it would pack it down, and then they'd weave it through again, and then they'd pack it down. It was all done by hand. They had these looms and everything, but they didn't have any power to do it. It was all, you know, done by hand. And so this is one of the reasons why in the old days cloth was extremely expensive. And prior to the Industrial Revolution, poorer folks especially did not have a lot of clothes. They might have 2-3 outfits at best. And because it was just expensive. Everything was homespun. As a matter of fact, as late as the 1860s and 1870s in the United States, a lot of things were still homespun. I remember reading that one of the, I think it was Longstreet, got Stonewall Jackson a new uniform that was factory made because his old uniform was made of homespun, which meant it was puckery and, you know, had little bumps and everything in the cloth and everything, because that's how it was done back in those days. And he got him a really fancy, you know, pressed uniform. So a fuller is somebody that when you weave the cloth, it's going to have places where it's heavier than in other spots. It's going to be uneven. Its texture is going to be uneven. And if you rolled it all out, it's going to have bubbles and puckers and everything else in it. And if you do that, you cut it and make cloth and stuff out of it, it's still going to be puckered and stuff. And then after you wash it, it's going to be even worse. This is what Jesus was talking about, putting new cloth on old clothes, and then you... as a patch, and then when you wash it, the new cloth shrinks away and pulls the hole away, and it's even worse than it was before. Because they didn't have the chemical processes that we have today, where you just, you know, buy it and it's all ready to go. Well, what are now the chemical processes that finish cloth, that make it usable, in the old days, that's what a fuller did. A fuller bleached the cloth, he washed the cloth, he got all the puckers and everything out, it was pre-shrunk and everything out so that they could sell it, and then it could be used to make clothes. So a fuller was the person who prepared the cloth. Some of you in newer translations, it'll say launderer because they don't want to go through this long discussion about what a fuller was. All right? And when it says the fuller's field, because they soaked these things, what was bleach here in 734 BC? It was lye. It was lye. And vegetable lye mostly. And so they would have these stone tanks, and they didn't always smell good. And they would have these stone tanks out there on the side of town that was downwind from the city, so the smell didn't offend people. And they would soak the cloth in that for 2, 3, 4 days or whatever, depending on the strength needed and so on. And then they would have the field where they would roll the cloth out and let it dry. And they also had people that actually walked on the cloth after it was out there wet and everything, and even after it dried, to work out all the stiffness and everything. They'd have a bunch of girls out there walking barefoot on this thing on the flat ground to work out all the puckers and everything. So that's the fuller's field. And so he goes up there in that section. That's where he meets the king. And it says, then said, and say it, so this is thus saith the Lord, because we have that at the beginning of verse 3. And say unto him, say unto King Ahaz, we're in verse 4, take heed and be quiet. This isn't shh, shh, shh. What he's saying is be quiet of soul. Let your anxieties go away. You have been shaken, you are fearful, you are trembling with fear. Be quiet, be calm. Be calm. Because... And it says, neither be faint-hearted, for these two tales of these smoking firebrands. What's a firebrand? Again, these aren't terms we use these days. What's a firebrand? What's that?
The torch thing.
Yeah, it'd be like a torch. And back in those days, you didn't have matches and stuff. You did the starting. I mean, they had ability to start fire from scratch and so on, but it was always much, much easier to be able to start a fire from something that existed before. And in the summertime, especially when the weather's nice, we have a fire pit in my backyard, and we'll get a fire going. And then what I'll do is, instead of letting it all burn out, I will cover it and smother it. Or pull it apart is what I'll more likely do. And sometimes if I've got a big enough pile of coals and stuff in there, there might actually be a hot spot, and the next night it'll still be enough hot in there that I can get it going again. And a firebrand would be, in this particular case, because he's talking about the end of a firebrand. You might have a piece of wood like this, and the end of it's all coals and stuff. And you remember when you were a kid, or your teenager especially, you'd pull that thing out because you got the cool end that was at the outside of the fire, and you could hold on to it, and you're going, and it would glow, and then there'd be the smoke coming out and everything. That's a firebrand. But what you've got here is you got the stub. It's burned down and you just got the stub. It's still glowing. It's still hot. It's still smoking, but there's just a stub left. And that's what he's calling these two kingdoms. These are just stubs. So fear not the two tail ends of these firebrands, for the fierce anger of reason with Assyria and the son of Remaliah, that would be Pekah. These two guys are threatening you. They're nothing to worry about. They're nothing to worry about. Because, verse 5, Syria, Ephraim, the son of Remaliah, have taken evil counsel against thee, saying, this is their plan, let us go up against Judah and vex it. Let us make a breach therein, breach through the city walls of Jerusalem. And let us set a king in the midst of it, even Tabeel. Now, we don't know who this Tabeel guy was, but the idea was that they were going to take Jerusalem, remove Ahaz, and put a puppet king in there that would do what they wanted him to do, so that they would have their ally against Assyria. That was their plan. Now, of course, part of the problem here, verse 6, is totally contrary to the promise of God. God had told them that it would be the line of David that would be the kings there in Israel, at least until the captivity. And we don't have the captivity here. So this can't come to pass. The promise of God must be maintained. Thus saith the Lord God, it shall not stand, neither shall it come to pass. For here's what's going to happen. Verse 8. For the head of Syria is Damascus, and the head of Damascus is reason. And within 65 years shall Ephraim be broken and be not a people. Now, I mentioned that the events described here are in 734 B.C. Tim, do you happen to remember when Samaria, when the northern kingdom, was finally taken by the Assyrians and the population deported? Do you remember the year?
I don't.
Okay, 722 B.C. was when that happened. 12 years after this. 12 years later. And the city was under siege for 3 years. So in 9 years, Samaria is going to be under siege. So only 9 years. And in 12 years, Samaria is taken and a huge percentage of the population is deported. But he says 65 years. What happened in 65 years? Well, in 65 years, in 669 BC, another Assyrian king had conquered a different area. And he had a bunch of people. The Assyrian policy was to break down nationalism, to break down a people's desire to rebel. And so what he did is he would instead of decimating the people, instead of doing genocide, they did some of that, but instead of doing genocide, because the people were producing, they're farmers, they're craftsmen, they're whatever. It's much better to keep the people alive if you can. But the king is thinking, I need to break down nationalism. I need to remove the concept of rebellion. And back in this day, to some extent even today, but back in this day especially, nationalism was tied to the land. And if you could take a significant number of the people from a particular country, especially the leadership, and uproot them and move them 600 or 700 miles over here and settle them here, you have broken their nationalism. They're going to be looking at surviving. They're going to be looking at building houses and maintaining their families. They're going to be looking at capitalism, but they're not going to be looking at nationalism. And that was Assyrian policy. And so 65 years after the, or turned out to be 50 some odd years after the destruction of Samaria, a later Assyrian king conquered a different part of the Middle East and took those people and he settled them in northern Israel. And those people mingled and intermarried over a period of time with the Jews that were still there. And this is where Samaritans come from. And so the Jewish kingdom in the north ceased to be a people. It was no longer distinctly Jewish. Instead, it became a melting pot, not only ethnically, but also religiously. And so the idea of an ethnic northern kingdom disappeared. It shall no longer be a people in 65 years. And it says in verse 9, and the head of Ephraim is Samaria, and the head of Samaria is Remaliah's son. If you don't believe, surely it will be established. And by the way, the northern kingdom, or the kingdom of Syria, let's see, was destroyed in, here we go, 732 B.C. So 2 years after this is all happening in our text, Damascus was sacked by the Assyrians. So these two northern kingdoms, the Arameans of Damascus and the Israelites out of Samaria, are desperate. They are desperate, and they are trying to get Jerusalem to side with them, and they won't do it because they think it's a losing bet. And the promise here from God is that you don't have to worry about it because these two northern kingdoms will indeed cease to exist in short order. And then we have a promise, an offer. Not more than an offer, it's a command. Starting in verse 10. Moreover, the Lord spake again unto Ahaz, saying, ask a sign of the Lord thy God. Ask it whether either in the depth or the height there above. If you want the stars to spell out that this is going to happen, you can ask this. If you want the rivers to flow up hills, it'll happen. But you ask the sign, you tell, and we'll do it, and God will do it. But he says, ask. He's not saying, if you want. He's saying, ask. Now, there's a reason behind this. And we don't get this in our text. This is where background comes in handy. What was Ahaz's hope in this whole situation? Was he doing something politically behind the scenes to help his situation? Yeah, he was. He had ambassadors up there talking to the Assyrian king, saying, you've got to come and help me. You have got to sack Damascus, and you have got to sack Samaria. So he's telling him, God wants you to ask for a sign. Now, Ahaz is looking to Assyria to deliver him. He should be looking to the Lord to deliver him. He should be looking at the promises of God. He's got a prophet there in his midst. He's got Isaiah. Micah was probably prophesying at the same time as well. He has prophets there that can get revelation directly from God. He's got the temple of God there. He is the man of God's choosing for the throne. He's of the line of David. And instead, he sends ambassadors up to Assyria trying to get the Assyrians to deliver him from the Syrians and the Israelites. And so his reply here in verse 12 is a false piety. What he's got is disobedience. He is wanting to set aside his reliance on the Lord, and he's going to look to Assyria to be his deliverer. It says in verse 12, but Ahaz says, I will not ask, neither will I tempt the Lord. Trying to sound pious. Oh, I wouldn't ask God for a sign. No. Far be it from me. I would not ask the Lord for a sign. Well, he doesn't want to be trusting the Lord. He's not trusting the Lord. He's trusting in Assyria. And this is why God said, ask the sign. It's a command, not an offer. And we know that from verse 13. He said, Hear ye now, O house of David, is it a small thing for you to weary men, but will you weary my God also? God told you to ask for a sign, and you're not going to do it. And you're giving me these platitudes, but you're not doing what God told you to do. Now, here's the key verse, the one that I said is the one with actually a lot of controversy. Didn't have a lot of controversy before, but it has in the last little over 100 years. Verse 14, therefore the Lord himself shall give you a sign. Behold, a virgin shall conceive and bear a son and shall call his name Emmanuel. Now, that is cited again in Matthew chapter 1 and verse 23. Emmanuel means literally in Hebrew, God with us. And that is a messianic prophecy, cited as so in Matthew's gospel. And you will find messianic prophecies scattered throughout Isaiah. Matter of fact, you're going to find more of them in Isaiah than any other book in the Old Testament, even more than the Psalms. A huge number of them here in Isaiah. And this one is in reference to the virgin birth and is cited as so. A virgin shall conceive. And those who deny the supernatural, those who do not believe in the inspiration of Scripture have been all over this verse. In right after World War II, the National Council of Churches produced a translation called the Revised Standard Version. And almost always the New Testament comes out first. And when the New Testament came out, it got a lot of praise from liberals and conservatives. It was reasonably well done. Modern language translation, fairly literal, and And so the Bible believers began to say, hey, this is a good translation. And some of them started using it in their churches and so on. And a few years pass, and then they finished the Old Testament. And the Old Testament was pretty good, except one glaring problem. And that's this verse. They said, therefore the Lord himself shall give you a sign. Behold, a young woman shall conceive and bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel. Now, the Hebrew word there is the Hebrew word Alma. There is no other word that is used for virgin in Hebrew. That is the word. That is, and every place where that word occurs, it is referring to a virgin. Now, the context does not always demand, or is not always talking about her virginity. But it is, it presupposes that this woman, and we're talking about women who are before they were married and so on, it presupposes their virginity. And that's the case for this word. But their theological presuppositions of denying the supernatural are coloring their interpretation of the and translation of the scripture. So we have a virgin, she shall conceive and bear a son and call his name Emmanuel. Of course, we know how that works with Mary and the birth of the Savior. Now, for the most part, verse 14 is a standalone as far as the messianic prophecy, because the two verses that follow deal with the current circumstance of Ahaz. It says, verse 15, butter and honey shall he eat, that he may know to refuse the evil and choose the good. I'll say, and then verse 16, for before the child can know to refuse the evil and choose the good, the land shall be that thou abhorrest shall be forsaken of both her kings. For years, verse 14 was a breeze for me. Verses 15 and 16 confused me. Part of it was I didn't see that they could be severed from verse 14. But even if they're not, you don't have a problem here. Verse 15, butter and honey. The word butter, if you have a newer translation, what do you have there instead of butter?
I got curds.
Curds. What are curds? Besides the folks who live in northern Iraq?
Cottage cheese.
Okay, cottage cheese. Or if you go down to the, anybody been to the Tillamook plant? David has. Okay, a few of you. Okay, and what do they give you at the end of your tour? Little bits of cheese, but they offer you some curds that have already been colored orange. And when you pop them in your mouth, they taste like a real, real mild cheese. But when you chew on them, they squeak in your teeth. It's kind of weird. It's almost like chewing styrofoam. And, but curds, whether you're making cottage cheese or cheese, can be brought about by either putting, what is that enzyme that they put in milk to make? What's that?
Ricin.
No, not ricin. Ricin's poison. I know what you're talking about. You're close. Anyway. Yeah, Aaron would be able to tell me. I just can't come up with it. Anyway, but you can buy this. You can turn goat milk into goat cheese just by dribbling some of this stuff in there, and it forces the thing to go right to curds. You can have milk do that by adding that, but in ancient days you didn't do that. They didn't have this. Chemical that you put in there. It's a natural chemical, but a chemical to put in there and cause your milk to curdle instantly. So how did they make their milk curdle? Same way we do if we don't drink it fast enough. You just let it sit there, and they didn't have refrigeration. And so what they do is they'd shake it and so on so that the curds didn't form. My father, when he was a young man, worked out, he was a hard-working guy and a farmer and so on, and he could eat just obscene amounts of food at a sitting. I remember he and a friend split 5 pounds of spaghetti, and that was before it was cooked. And they did it at a meal, and then for dessert they ate a pie, and they each drank a gallon of milk at the meal. Of course, they were only like 24 at the time. My father's the one that told me, never chug a lug a gallon of milk. That's a practical joke that some people do. They'll challenge some, football player guy. I bet you can't chug a lug a gallon of milk, and you can only do it on an empty stomach anyway. What happens if you chug a lug a gallon of milk? Nope, that's not the problem. Maybe a little bit, but that's not the big problem. It turns into one big curd in your stomach, and it takes about 3 or 4 days for the stomach acids to whittle it down. You feel amazingly full and painfully uncomfortable, and it lingers. All right, and so they would shake this, and if you're dealing with sheep and goats, the curd is much smaller. Is much smaller. You can't make cottage cheese out of goat because the curd is much, much smaller. And this is, by the way, why some children have a hard time with cow milk because the curd is too big, but they can handle goat milk because the curd is much smaller. And so they would take this and they would let it go to curd. They would pour off the whey. You know, little Miss Muffet sat on a tuffet eating her curds in whey. Okay, the whey is the liquid that's there between the curds. So they'd pour that off because that's really the sour part, is the whey. And then if you're making cheese, then you press the curds together, and that's how you make a block of cheese. You do some other things to it, but that's basically what it is. And poor people, if they didn't have property for a farm, and this is going to come in here a little bit later toward the end of the chapter, if they didn't have property for a farm, but they had a little bit of livestock that they could range out here in non-cultivated property, maybe property that was too steep or too dry to grow crops on or something like that, if somebody had maybe two or three sheep, and they'd send one of the kids out for the day to watch the sheep, and then the sheep would come in the morning. What would they do with the sheep? Yes, you can milk sheep. And you can milk goats. And in this country, most if you've ever had goat or sheep cheese, sheep milk, it's usually in the form of some kind of cheese from France or something. But yeah, you can milk goats and sheep. And poor people, instead of living on vegetables and living on bread, because they didn't have property and they weren't cultivating ground because they'd sold off their property, they'd lost their inheritance and so on, lived on curds. And also, bees are abundant in the Middle East in the areas where they get enough moisture. This is one of the parts of the world where the honeybee is actually native. It isn't a critter that's been brought in. It's native to this area. And wild bees are very, very common in this part of the world. And so a food that was available to poor people, if they were willing to go to the trouble to get it, was honey and what they could get from the milk of their livestock that they are milking morning and evening. And so poor people, he's talking about a weaned child. And so back in this day, children were breastfed until they were three, sometimes even four. And so what do you transition them to? Well, curds and honey. My kids were transitioned to pickles and brie cheese. That was the first solid food David ever had. We had somebody over and they're stuffing brie cheese and pickles into them. He managed. But the idea here is that he's just a small child. He has transitioned to curds and honey. Why do you put the honey in it, by the way? You got little ones. Why do you put honey in it?
Tastes good.
Yeah. Oh, you don't like your curds? They're a little sour for you. Let's put a little honey in here. And so they'd sweeten it up a little bit to get the kids to eat it. And so before the child gets to this stage, and the idea is a poor family and so on, before a child would grow old enough to be able to make his own decisions, to choose the evil refuse the evil and choose the good, both these kingdoms would be gone. Before the child will know to refuse the evil and choose the good, the land that thou abhorrest, these two kingdoms will both be gone. So before a child reaches the age of majority, which, you know, how old is a child when they get the, go through their bar mitzvah? 13. 12, is it 12 or 13?
12.
Okay. Before the, well, it doesn't matter because this happens before then. If you look at the chronology, before a child reaches that age, both those kingdoms are gone. And that's the illustration he's using here. A small child growing up, before he reaches that particular age, both these kingdoms are going to be gone. You're not going to have to worry about them anymore. Instead, you're going to have to worry about Assyria, and that's going to be a bigger problem for Israel for quite a few years, or for Judah for quite a few years to follow. So, down through verse 16. Now, starting verse 17, we have an explanation of what is going to happen down the road, future. Not just in the immediate future during the Ahaz's reign, but years and years down the road. Israel becomes, you still have Edom, Moab, the Philistines, and the Ammonites. But the two bigger, more powerful kingdoms of Israel and Syria are gone. And instead, everything is shifted to smaller kingdoms, and by far the biggest, the most powerful of these five little kingdoms that are still left, the Philistines, Judah, Ammon, Moab, and Edom, the most powerful of these is Judah. They are the holdout, and they are wedged, these five little bitty kingdoms here are wedged between the gigantic Assyrian Empire and the Egyptians. And how come these guys didn't gobble these guys up? Why? These are a buffer state. These are a buffer between these guys. And that way the Assyrians don't have to fight the Egyptians, and the Egyptians don't have to fight the Assyrians. Instead, all we have to do is try to cultivate the alliance or force the alliance of these guys to side with one of us instead of the other guy. And that's what you had going back and forth for years after this. And so it says there in verse 17, the Lord will bring upon thee and upon thy people and upon thy father's house. So this is going to go on down the road. And upon thy father's house, days that have not come from the day that Ephraim, that'd be the northern kingdom, departed from Judah, even the king of Assyria. And it shall come to pass in that day, I love this, that the Lord shall hiss for the fly that is in Egypt, that is in the uttermost parts of the rivers of Egypt, and for the bee that is in the land of Assyria. What in the world does that mean? Now, if you have a newer translation, the idea of hiss is the action, not the sound. It's like, all right. I do it very seldom now, but when my kids were little, especially if we were in a crowd and I couldn't find them, this is why I did it. I'd whistle for my kids, which worked great because, there could be, you know, I could be in a group of 200 or 300 people and I just go, you know, whistle, and here come my little kids out from the crowd right where I am. Everybody else is saying, where's my kids? And they're looking around and everything. All I have to do is whistle, and here they come. And so the idea of whistling is what a shepherd would do for a dog or even for his sheep. He would whistle. The animals would come because they recognize the whistle. The Lord is going to whistle for the Egyptians and for the Assyrians. They are going to come, and Judah is going to be having to deal with the Assyrians from the north and with the Egyptians from the south. And he talked about the fly of Egypt and the bee of Assyria. In Egypt, from what I read, Egypt is kind of like Puyallup is during the fair and for about a week afterward, especially if the weather's warm. And I know you folks live here in the valley. What have you noticed when the fair's in town? There's flies everywhere. And you can live a half mile or a mile from the fairgrounds, and there's still flies everywhere. My wife and I used to live in one of the apartment complexes, and that's, you know, we're west of the fairgrounds, so the prevailing winds are going the other way. My wife and I used to live in one of the apartments just down the hill from the hospital. Oh my word, we were there for 3.5 years. And we'd keep the place closed up, we'd both come home, and there'd be like 30 or 40 flies in our apartment. How in the world? And then we got a fly swatter, we'd go around the house, we'd kill them all, and then after dinner, there's like another dozen and a half or two dozen of them flying around the house. Where in the world are these stupid things coming from? They're coming down the chimney is what they were. But there's flies everywhere. Egypt is a land of flies. They are just everywhere. You've got enough moisture. You've got stagnant air. You've got refuse and stuff piled everywhere. It stinks. It is a land of flies. They are just everywhere. And so he's talking about the hordes of the Egyptians, and he uses the illustration of flies. I'm going to whistle for the flies of Egypt, so you're going to have a huge mass of these hordes from Egypt coming down. And then I mentioned that bees are common in parts of the Middle East, especially if there's enough moisture. And I also, they didn't, as far as I know, I'd have to do some checking, but as far as I know, they did not, at this time, cultivate bees. You didn't need to. They were all over the place. And if you wanted to get some honey, you got a firebrand, okay? And you blew on it to make sure you had your smoke. And you may have wrapped yourself up in some thicker clothing to help protect you. You're going to get stung some. But you'd go in there and you'd take out a bunch of the combs and stuff. You ever seen a wild beehive, honey beehive? My son has. It's not a big round gray nest or something. They don't build an outside of this thing. What have they got? What have you seen? Okay, and you just have these combs hanging inside those things. In the Middle East, where it's drier, what they do is they're usually on a cliffside, and they're on the negative of a cliff, out of the weather, and you'll have these panels of honeycomb just hanging from the roof of this cliff, or in some other sheltered spot, and you'll have a beehive in there, and Assyria up in the north is not like it is in, if you've seen, remember seeing the pictures of Babylon, not Babylon, but Baghdad. Baghdad's not very far from Babylon, ancient Babylon, and it's flat as a pancake there. I mean, just, it's like West Texas. It's just flat and it goes on forever and ever and ever, seems like. You go north in Iraq and you start getting some roll to the country. And where Assyria was, there was a lot of roll to the country and you had a lot of bees up there. And so, just as you have an abundance of bees, we're gonna whistle for the flies, the hordes of flies to come up from Egypt, and we're gonna whistle for the swarms of bees to come down from Assyria. And Judah is gonna be wedged between these two hordes coming down, vying for dominance, and these five little petty kingdoms are caught between the two. And they serve a value as a buffer. They weren't initially destroyed. They served as a value for, as a buffer. And what's interesting is the Egyptians nor the Assyrians ever destroyed these five. They used them. But they put them through a lot of hardship. And, a great many difficulties. Matter of fact, Israel or Judah was almost destroyed under the reign of Hezekiah. The Assyrians, the only time the Assyrians ever lost in a siege was when the Lord struck down the soldiers that were besieging Jerusalem in 2 Kings. We'll also see that later on here in the book of Isaiah, the same context. And so you have the Lord whistling for these. And it says in verse 19, "And they shall come and shall rest all of them in the desolate valleys and in the holes of the rocks and upon all thorns and upon all bushes, like bugs would, like locust hordes would. So these will come down and occupy the land." Verse 20, "In the same day the Lord shall with a razor that is hired, namely them beyond the river," that would be Assyria, "by the king of Assyria, the head and the hair of the feet, and shall also consume the beard." In 2 Kings, in the beginning of 2 Kings, about halfway through 2 Kings, or 2 Samuel rather, the king of Ammon died. And David sent ambassadors to Ammon to comfort the crown prince who had the new king regarding the death of his father. And his advisors said, "These guys are spies. They're not coming here to comfort you. They're coming here to spy out the land so they can capture your kingdom." And so what did they do with these guys, with the ambassadors that had come down to comfort them? They did two different things to them. They shaved their beards and they cut off their clothes right here. And then sent them home. And word was sent, and David said, "Oh, this is humiliating. I mean, you guys stay in Jericho," he says, "until your beards be grown." Because to be clean shaven in that day was considered a great, great shame. It was considered effeminate. And so the Assyrians here are going to humiliate, is the idea here. The Assyrians are going to humiliate the folks there in Judah. "And it shall come to pass," verse 21 rather, here's going to be the poverty of the land because of the Egyptians and mostly because of the Assyrians. "It shall come to pass in that day that a man shall nourish a young cow and two sheep." That's all he'll have left, a cow and two sheep. "And it shall come to pass that for the abundance of milk that they shall give, he shall eat butter. For butter and honey, or curds and honey, shall everyone eat that is left in the land." You're not going to have enough people to do large cultivation. You're not going to be able to grow wheat. You're not going to be able to grow barley. You're not going to have enough people to do this, to cultivate the land. You're not going to have enough livestock. You're not going to have oxen to be able to cultivate the land, to plow the fields and to be able to sow the fields and so on. You guys are going to, the land is going to be desolate. You're going to have so few people left that people will be eating curds and honey, as was alluded to earlier in verse 15. Instead of the staple of life being bread in Judah, it will be curds because it just won't be there. "It'll come to pass in that day, and it shall come to pass for the abundance of milk that they shall give it hastily." Okay, verse 23. "And it shall come to pass in that day that every place shall be where there were 1,000 vines and 1,000 silverlings." That's the idea of a big vineyard that was worth 1,000 silver coins or pieces of silver. "It shall even be briars and thorns. It'll all be overgrown. And with arrows and with bows shall men come thither, because the land shall become briars and thorns." Places that used to be farms are now places where people go hunting. "And on all the hills that shall be digged with a mattock." What's a mattock? They still use those in parts of the world. What's a mattock? Sort of. It's kind of like a pickaxe with a blade, with a wide blade, depending, and it varies just depending on where you are and what you're trying to do. And a poor man, you know, he uses it as a hoe, or he uses it if he's got a smaller piece of ground, he doesn't have enough space to be able to bring a plow in, or he doesn't want to bother. He uses a mattock. He's got a long handle on it, and he turns his soil with that. Just going through and turning the soil with that. We might use a shovel today if you have a little garden. My great aunt Rosie had a shovel. She died when she was 102 or 103, and she used the same shovel for the last 60 years of her life. Just a regular, you know, rounded end shovel. And her shovel was shaped like this at the end because she'd worn the bottom and didn't want to bother getting another shovel. But she turned her garden over, even when she was in her late 90s, turned it over with a shovel. And so a mattock would be used for the same thing. There shall not come thither the fear of briars and thorns, but it shall be for sending forth of cattle and for the treading of lesser cattle. Lesser cattle will be sheep and goats. So you're not going to have Judah cultivated with vineyards and fields and gardens and so on as it used to be. But instead it's going to be desolate, and you're going to have a handful of people left. And what they're going to do is the former places that used to be immaculate gardens and vineyards and all this beautiful country that produces just piles and piles of food, instead it becomes the pasture land for the little bit of livestock that's left, and the people will be eating curds and honey because that's what they can grow. All right, so here we have the future of Judah. Judah will continue to be a people, but Judah will be humiliated and Judah will be impoverished. But you have a promise that they will survive. And they're still here today. But you also have the promise of Messiah there in verse 14. All right, any questions on our text tonight? Isaiah chapter 7.
I have one. Well, Ahaz, how come he wanted Assyria to protect him? Did he know that they were a corrupt people?
Yeah. You know? Well, here's your choice. Here's your choice. I've got... I have my choice of either being destroyed by Israel and Syria, and it's just... Now, this is just from purely pragmatic political perspective. He should have been trusting the Lord. But just from a political perspective, apart from considering God, it's me against these two big kingdoms. And they're going to come in and they're going to ravage the land. And even if we survive the siege, once they leave, the land is going to be desolate. I mean, they're just going to destroy the countryside. And we're going to be hard put for food and everything else because they would have destroyed everything that was out there in the fields and stuff. But if I want deliverance, if I want some, I can prevent this invasion right now, maybe. If I contact this empire over here that's threatening to invade Syria and Israel anyway.
Oh, anyway, okay.
And because that's why they were coming in to attack Judah. They were trying to get Syria and Israel was trying to get Judah on their side to fight the Assyrians. Well, Judah's looking at this and saying, even if we were fighting on the side of Israel and Syria, we're still going to lose. So why should I side with them? Why don't I just throw in my lot with the Assyrians? I'll be paying them tribute, but at least we'll be able to survive. That was Ahaz's point of view. Okay, anything else? All right, let's close in prayer. Father, we do thank you for your word. Thank you for the promises that you have made. Father, we have seen several things here. We've seen the promise that the kingdom would survive, and although they might be humiliated, and they might be impoverished, Father, yet you would preserve the people. And although they might be limited to just few in number, yet, Father, you would preserve them as a people. And, Father, thank you also for a promise made 700-plus years in advance that Messiah would come and be born of a virgin. Father, thank you that it came about exactly as you had decreed it would be. Father, thank you that your word is true, your word is sure. We pray for Christ's sake. Amen.